So we read in the Parsha this week a story that we all can really like. It's a really, really great moment. It's the story of the Benot Tzlofchad, the daughters of Tzlofchad. Some of you are nodding your head. You know why we like this story. So Tzlofchad was this guy. He died. Baruch Dayan Hemet. He died, and he had five daughters and no sons. So the five daughters go before Moshe, and they say, Moses, our father died. He was a good man. He wasn't even in the Korach rebellion, a good guy, and he only had five daughters. So we can't inherit the land that would have gone to his sons. And Moses, in a wonderful moment of humility, says, huh, yeah, I don't know. Let me go ask God. I'll be right back. And he comes back, and God said, yeah, no, they should inherit. They should get it. We like that story, don't we? It's a great story. It's like this proto-feminist story. These women stand up for themselves and for their rights, and they are not brushed off in this patriarchal way that we would expect in the Bible, but rather they are treated with dignity and respect, not only by Moses, but by God. Good stuff, right? You know where I'm going. All right, so there are other parts of the Torah where you have, you know, if a young woman is raped, she has to marry her rapist. Okay, well, we're not going to go there. We like this story, though. Right? It's interesting how we do that, right? And interestingly, when you look at other commentaries on our story of the daughters of Tzlofchad, you get a very different take, particularly when you go into the Jewish rabbinic tradition. In the Tzene Urena, for example, they don't necessarily extol the daughters for being so feminist. Instead, they extol the daughters for being such nice Jewish girls. They talk about how they noticed that none of them were married. But you know what? The reason why they weren't married is because they are such fine, upstanding young ladies that they are waiting until they find just the right guy with the perfect piety and perfect lineage, the perfect nice Jewish boy. Aren't they wonderful that they are such pious goyles? Interesting, huh? That's where the tradition goes with it. So here we're looking at it and we're saying, yay, feminism! And the tradition looks at it and says, yay, nice girls who fit right into the patriarchal paradigm. So what I want to talk about today is not so much about the progressive or lack thereof merits of the Torah, but rather this interesting tendency that we have in our humanity to see what we want to see in the text and to filter out the stuff that we don't really like in the text, right? The technical term for this behavior is confirmation bias, right? It's that tendency when we approach the text, we are always desperate to find our values there and to lift them up and to celebrate them and to really try not to pay attention to the other things. And by the way, it's not just the text. Confirmation bias is a human trait in all of humanity. We do this with everything. We go out in the world, and the first thing we naturally are going to do is we're going to look to confirm our bias. We have our idea. We have our narrative about what life is. We have our narrative that we live by about what is important and what's valuable. And we want to see that reflected. And we don't want, we'll just pretend the other stuff isn't there, even if people tell us something to the contrary. And in our era of the internet and social media, this tendency toward confirmation bias is making the world all the more dangerous. And so that's actually what I want to talk about this morning. Now, bear with me. I'm going to take you through some rabbinic texts here to elaborate on this point. The Talmud makes a point about the story of the five daughters of Tzlofchad. The Talmud says they were very careful when they spoke to Moses in specifically saying that their father was not amongst the rebels with Korach who rebelled against Moshe. And Maimonides comments on this and elaborates. He says, indeed, the daughters were very careful In fact, they knew their halacha, because according to halacha, if you are a moreid b'malchut, which means if you are somebody who rebels against authority, then you legally, according to Jewish law, lose your right to inheritance. So they were being very legalistic according to the rabbinic tradition, right? Very learned women. They were being very legalistic and making sure that they are not in the, that their father was not the category of moreid b'malchut. Okay. So the Chafetz Chaim takes this very same idea and pushes it forward in an interesting direction. He says, yes, indeed, they're very careful. They wanted to name that their father was not in the amongst the rebels. But in turn, their announcing this then put Moshe in a very difficult bind. And why did it put him in a bind? Because it put him in the potential of being biased. Why? Because Korach led a rebellion against him. And if he suddenly hears, oh, their father was on the good, he was on my side, I like them, I'm going to give them what they want. So Moshe, in being in the role of a judge in this case, was scrupulous in his desire to avoid bias at any cost, so much so that he said, wait a minute, hang on, he went to God. And yeah, God said, it's okay, Moshe, you're not biased here, they do deserve it. Interestingly, in the Zohar, they take it in the opposite direction, but they come to the same conclusion. So, I'll explain. So, when the daughters of Tzlofchad go before Moshe, according to the Zohar, what do they say? They said, our father died b'midbar. What does b'midbar mean in Hebrew? In the desert. And the Zohar says, don't read it as b'midbar, but read it as b'midaber. What does that mean? Speaking, talking. He died from speaking or talking. And what does that mean? The Zohar explains. He died. Yes, he wasn't in the Korach rebellion, but he was one of the kvetchers. There were a lot of kvetchers, especially in the book of Numbers, aren't there? Right? They're always kvetching. Lama helitunum in Mitzrayim. Why did you bring us up out of Mitzrayim? We had cucumbers and melons and leeks, and we had bread and we had water. Oy, oy, oy. So he was one of the kvetchers, and they were letting him know, and therefore Moses was worried that he might be biased against them. So he went to God, and God said, no, no, do in their favor. So we see that Moses is terrified of his own capacity to project his bias onto his decisions and choices and actions, and he literally goes to divine lengths to ensure that he is not biased. So I guess the lesson we can take from all of this is that all of us, in our time, we have to be hypervigilant about our own tendency toward bias. And lu yehi, if only we had Moses' ability to go to God directly and make sure that we are actually operating from the honest to God truth. But of course, we don't have that ability. We don't have that kind of access to perfect, unbiased truth in this world. But I believe that our tradition gives us the next best thing, the best that we can hope for. And that comes in the Talmud, in the famous discussion about the famous disputes between the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai, right? And it says, Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. What does it say? What does that mean? Elu ve'elu, these and these, divrei Elohim chayim, the words of the living God, meaning both sides spoke the words of God, and yet they disagreed with each other. And yet we rule like Hillel. Why do we rule like Hillel? Because Hillel's school always taught the opposing opinion of their opponents before they taught their own opinions. And what I take from this is the lesson that, first of all, absolute truth is something that we human beings, if we're not Moses, we don't have access to. That only lives in the realm of God. And anybody who says, I know the absolute truth, I know God's absolute truth, is dangerous. The best we can hope for in our humanity, and this is deeply ensconced in the rabbinic tradition, the best that we can hope for is partial truth. And that has very painful implications, because if the best that we can, any of us can own, is partial truth, it means that those who disagree with us also own partial truth. That's hard, particularly in this day and age. I'll share with you one of my very personal spiritual practices that I do, which is whenever somebody comes up to me and criticizes me, not that I'm ever criticized, it's a hazard of my trade. Whenever somebody comes up and criticizes me, they say, you know, Rabbi, you're an idiot. What is the natural response when somebody calls you an idiot? I'm not an idiot, you're an idiot. Right? So I try, and often fail, but I try to take, I guess, what we can call a Moses and Hillel moment, to take a breath and ask myself the question, could they be right? And you know what I'm looking for? I'm looking for, in that moment, sometimes it just is a second, I'm looking for where they're right, where it's true. I might not find it in the situation they're talking about, but I'm still going to look for the partial truth in what they said. And this is my crazy little spiritual practice. I might have to go back, you know, 10 years to the last time I was an idiot. It's more, okay, it was probably 10 minutes ago. But I go back to the last time I can remember, and in that moment, I join with them. I can find it somewhere, usually in a millisecond, where I've been an idiot. And in that moment, what am I doing? I'm with them, and I'm not being reactive. And what that results in is it disarms the other person. Because all I can say at that point is, tell me more. Tell me more. That's the practice. And believe me, I fail at it more than I succeed at it. But it's, you know, like any practice, I work at it. And that's important. It's in our capacity to take this Moses and Hillel moment. That's what I'm doing. I'm taking that moment to depart from and to see if I can find the ultimate truth, which of course I can't, but I'm going to see if I can find it. And then what do? I'm taking their argument and putting it before my own. That's what Hillel did in that moment. Could they be right? In our day and age, our society is becoming so polarized in such a toxic way that we are all, each and every one of us, falling deeper and deeper into our own biases. It's becoming more and more entrenched, as I mentioned, through the internet and through social media, which is an echo chamber of confirmation bias. And it takes our own capacity for small-mindedness and emboldens it, not only on the right, folks, but also on the left. It's all of us. And that's why we all have to practice this spiritual practice of taking this Moses and Hillel moment and asking ourselves the most painful question we can ask. I hate having to do this. I hate it. Where could they be right? By the way, we could ask ourselves that question, and we won't find it. It might be they're just wrong, and that's okay. But in that pause, in that moment, you create a spaciousness. You create the potential for connection. Remember what our greatest charge is as the Jewish people in the world. Our charge is to take all the brokenness of this world, all the brokenness of the universe, all the broken shards, and put them back together again. And that begins with our capacity to look into our own brokenness. That means not only recognizing where we are partially right, partially true, but also looking at our own brokenness of our bias and our biases. And then do the same thing with the other side, to find not only their bias, but the partial truth that lives there as well. Only then can we finally make this world whole again. Shabbat Shalom, everyone. We continue now with a Chatzi Kaddish before the service of Musaf, page 184.